This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Anybody tonight who is into religion, it is important that we are told clearly from the platform tonight that religion will bind us up. So religion binds, but Jesus sets free. Some of you people tonight have been religious for years, but it never changed you. In fact, it probably made you worse. The more religious we get, the worse we become, the more bound up we become. You say, why is that? Because the basic word behind the word religion is a Latin word, religare. And the meaning of the word religare means to bind.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Last week it was a U-turn on Syria. This week, North Korea. 3 months into the Trump presidency, what was the point in voting? We take a look at the US threats to China this week, because they are the target, really, of this US Navy carrier strike force that's now set off for the Korean Peninsula. The US empire going bankrupt economically and morally is the only option to kick out militarily. And the 2004 Beslan school siege in North Ossetia is condemned by the European Court. Why did so many hostages die? And is the European Court right to condemn the Russian military? Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Bristol's best pubs guide from a man whose job title is a pubs officer. Yes, he's from the Campaign for Real Ale. And they're in the know for sure. Bristol has one of the country's biggest branches. Also, urban farmers supplying some of the city's top restaurants. It's Grow Bristol, which was set up as part of Bristol Green Capital. And if you've got a pain or other problem a doctor can't fix, we hear about a new healing centre for all faiths and none at City Road Baptist Church every Wednesday. But I think we'll start this week, Martin, with yesterday's dramatic interview with Syrian President Bashar Assad, who's been telling the world he thinks last week's chemical weapons attack on Gan Shahon was a fabrication, Martin. He calls it a play.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with him. I mean, obviously, there are various theories floating around about what actually happened.
Why?
Why are the various theories?
No, why do you agree with him?
Because of the timing. I mean, one of the suggestions was that the Syrian airstrike had hit a chemical weapons depot of the al-Qaeda forces. And I think Konashenkov, the Russian spokesperson, had suggested that. And that's been suggested by a retired colonel from the CIA. There's a whisper of that. That's one of the suggestions about what's happened. I'm more inclined to the view that it was an engineered false flag, very similar to what happened in Ghouta.
Why?
Why? Because of the timing. Because Trump had just said that he was about to accept Assad as not going anywhere, and the Syrian army are winning the war. But of course, the rebels have got every incentive to create a chemical warfare incident that they can turn that round.
You see, what's happened is
they've got means, motive, and opportunity.
Both the British Foreign Office and the State Department were saying, "Well, of course, we have to just face the facts. Bashar Assad is the president, and he will probably stay president." Now it's all turned around again.
Yeah, and that will be the purpose of the false flag attack, is to put the pressure on Trump to, do something, anything, which is what he's just done. And now, of course, he won't be able to back down because he's said a lot of silly stuff.
Okay, well, that's...
let his mouth run away with
enough him. From you and me. Let's have a listen now to... I've edited this down a little bit, but I think hopefully it'll get all the main points in that Bashar Assad was saying yesterday.
Actually, no one has investigated what happened that day in Khan Sheikhoun till that moment. As you know, Khan Sheikhoun is under the control of Al-Nusra Front, which is a branch of Al-Qaeda. So the only information the world have had till this moment is published by Al-Qaeda branch. No one has any other information. We don't know if the whole pictures or video that we've been seeing are true or fabricated. That's why we asked for investigation into what happened in Khan Sheikhoun. This is the second. Al-Qaeda sources said that the attack happened at 6:30 in the morning, while the Syrian attack in the same area was at around noon, between 11:30 to 12. So they're talking about two different stories or event. So there was no order to make any attack. We don't have any chemical weapons. We gave up our arsenal a few years ago. Even if we have them, we wouldn't use them. And we had never used our chemical arsenal in our history. Our impression that the West, mainly the United States, is hand in glove with the terrorists. They fabricated the whole story in order to have a pretext for the attack. It wasn't attack because of what happened in Khan Sheikhoun. It's one event. It's a stage one. The play that we saw on the social networking and on TVs, the propaganda, and the stage two is the military attack. That's what we believe is happening, because it's only a few days, 2 days, 48 hours between the play and the attacks, and no concrete evidence about anything. The only thing were allegations and propaganda and then strike. About the attack, it's not clear whether it happened or not, because how can you verify a video? You have a lot of fake videos now, and you have the proof that those videos were fake, like the white helmets, for example. They are Al-Qaeda, they are Nusra Front, who shaved their beard, wore white hats, and appeared as humanitarian heroes, which is not the case. The same people were killing Syrian soldiers, and you have the proof on the internet anyway. So the same thing for that chemical attack. We don't know whether those dead children, were they killed in Khan Sheikhoun, were they dead at all? Who committed the attack, if there was attack? You have no information at all, nothing at all, no one investigated.
So you think it's a fabrication?
Definitely, 100% for us it's fabrication. We don't have arsenal, we're not going to use it. And you have many indications, if you don't have proof, because no one has concrete information or evidences. But you have indications. For example, if you want to use it, if you have it, and if you want to use it, again, this is, if we suppose, why to use it against civilians, not to use it against the terrorists that we are fighting? In that area, we don't have army, we don't have battles in Khan Sheikhoun, and it's not strategic area. Why to attack it? Well, what the reason? Militarily, I'm talking about from a military point of view. Of course, the foundation for us morally, we wouldn't do it if we have it. We wouldn't have the will, because morally this is not acceptable. We won't have the support of the public. So every indication is against the whole story. So we can say that this play that they staged doesn't hold together. The story is not convincing by any means.
With the US airstrike, Trump seems to have changed his position on you and Syria drastically. You have the feeling that you lost what you have called a potential partner?
I said if it was conditional.
Yeah.
If they are serious in fighting terrorists, we're going to be partner. And I said, not only United States, whoever wants to fight the terrorists, we are a partner. This is basic for us. Actually, what has been proven recently, that they are hand in gloves with those terrorists. The United States and the West, they're not serious in fighting the terrorists. And yesterday, some of their statements were defending ISIS. They were saying that ISIS doesn't have chemical weapons. They are defending ISIS against the Syrian government and the Syrian army. So actually, you cannot talk about partnership between us who work against the terrorists and who fight the terrorism and the others who are supporting explicitly the terrorists.
Well, thankfully, the G7 meeting, Martin, decided that there weren't going to be any new sanctions imposed on Russia, apart from some, I think, on some particular associates of Vladimir Putin as a result of this, blaming the Russians for some reason. But I suppose the main take-home from all of this is that we've lost this agreement, air-sharing information agreement, between the US and Russia now. So the US are flying around in Syria in their US Air Force jets, and the Russian Air Force is also flying around in its Russian Air Force jets, and it's quite feasible that the two might get tangled up.
It is, although I understand that the amount of US or NATO Air Force intervention in Syria has gone down dramatically because the Russians have basically said, we're no longer going to coordinate with you, and that means that there's every possibility that they might be shot down. And on that basis, they've actually stopped many of the missions that they were carrying on. And the Russians don't have to do anything there. They haven't shot anybody down. They've just said, we're not going to cooperate with you anymore on this. And, you've got the possibility of being shot down. And I think that's where we're at. If there is a coordinated air assault on the Syrian air defence, then the Russians will intervene, and we're going to see lots of NATO casualties.
We had the United Nations Security Council on Wednesday night as well. Russia vetoed the West's draft agreement, or whatever it is, resolution, to have an investigation. So why did they do that? That sounds counterproductive.
No, the Syrians and the Russians are calling for an independent investigation. But what the British and others put forward was not an independent investigation. It was basically saying, we know who's done this, it's the Syrians, and therefore we're going to take steps.
I know one of the things they wanted to do was have access to every Syrian airbase and go all over it, which was within range of this site. Mm. One of the most interesting things I think Assad said there was that that this area wasn't actually even involved in any fighting.
Well, that's right. It's a rear area controlled by al-Nusra al-Qaeda, and the White Helmets are the only source for the story that all of these people have been killed. And in fact, if people look on the internet and they can see the videos, so-called dead people, when the cameras are running, they come alive again. So that suggests.
How
that
do you mean they come alive?
What are being presented as dead bodies, when the camera pans back over them, they're actually their eyes are open. In other words, it's acting. There may have been no chemical attack at all. That's what Assad is suggesting.
And what about this idea that the chemical attack itself is supposed to have taken place at 6:30 in the morning, and yet the air raid in that area took place at noon?
Well, indeed. I mean, this is what's beginning to come out, all of these anomalies in the so-called story that we've been told. And also, of course, another thing that people have pointed out, it can't possibly be sarin, because the people are handling the bodies with no gloves and protective gear on. They would die immediately if the sarin had been the gas that was used.
But, I mean, surely Assad could just be lying.
He could be, and surely the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda, could be lying. And the White Helmets, although they're funded by the British government, set up by a British military intelligence officer, James Lemessurier, based in Turkey, they could be lying. I put it to you that they're more likely to be lying than Assad.
It does sound strange to me that this entire story has been sort of off the back of, effectively, al-Qaeda and al-Nusra sources.
That's right. Well, of course, they've got very good PR paid for by the British government, i.e. the White Helmets. And in actual fact, we know now what happened at Ghouta some years ago was definitely carried out by the al-Nusra Front using Libyan sarin supplied by NATO intelligence. That's what Simon Hirsch wrote in the London Review of Books in two very important articles, The Red Lines and The Rat Lines, which I presume Boris Johnson and others have read. But of course, I would be presuming wrong, wouldn't I? Boris Johnson hasn't read it, doesn't know what he's talking about. And of course, the other obvious thing to point out is everybody thought they knew what had happened immediately. And of course, nobody knows what's happened in an incident like that immediately. And if you're jumping to conclusions, that's because you've already drawn a conclusion. And of course, the suggestion is that some people had advance warning that there was going to be a chemical weapons attack. Now, that suggests that the whole thing is probably a psychological warfare operation by NATO intelligence services, MIT in Turkey, the Saudis, the British, the Americans, working with their allies in Al-Qaeda, and who they've been working with for the last 30
years.
When
this US colonel you mentioned, we'll put a link up to his article on the show page, pointed out that the way that the sarin casualties were being treated was would possibly have killed the people who were treating them.
That's right.
Because he'd been trained in it all, and you know, for the US Army. Suddenly the story changed, didn't it? Say, well, it was sarin and chlorine.
Yes. In other words, there wasn't. It probably was chlorine. And one of the suggestions is that it's either all acting or they'd captured a load of pro-regime civilians from a nearby village. And this is what they've done before. They then kill those people and say, oh, look, the evil government's killed these people. And of course, it's a way of punishing the pro-regime civilians.
BCFM. Also this week, 43 people were killed and 100 wounded in Palm Sunday in a bomb attack on churches in Egypt. Church of the Nile Delta town of Tanta was filled with worshippers at the time of the blast. Hearing today that quite a lot of Christians in Egypt are afraid to go to church. First thing I'll say is that this is almost back to the days before the Arab Spring. These bomb attacks on churches were taking place, weren't they?
Well, during the Arab Spring, there was a bomb attack on the cathedral in Alexandria, which was shown to have been carried out by the government in order to discredit the opposition. So when something like this happens, it's definitely an evil act. It's definitely an act of terrorism.
You had someone from the Interior Ministry, in fact, went to see the British Secret Service in... they went to see MI6 at the British Embassy in Egypt and said, look, you know, we were asked, and I'm certainly aware, that the Interior Ministry was involved in planting this bomb.
Yes. So, in other words, that's what could be happening. Incidentally, of course, you've got a Sunni majority in Egypt, and they voted pretty overwhelmingly for the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood were then banned from standing in the election against al-Sisi.
They weren't just banned, were they? They were arrested and some of them executed.
Yes, and thousands of them were tortured and executed.
I mean, it does seem to me what happened in Egypt after the Arab Spring and the Morsi government and then the Sisi coup, Sisi, of course, being the defence minister under Mubarak, very, very close ties to NATO and the United States. What was happening there was it was just passing on from a portion of democracy for a couple of years or so, and then it was just simply back to the same old story. And in fact, Mubarak has now been released from jail. He was jailed for all sorts of crimes that he committed beforehand by the Morsi government, and now he's out walking the streets again.
Well, these elements are what's called in Egyptian parlance Falul elements. These are the people that used to be running the country and still are running the country in alliance with their allies in Britain and the US, etc. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, as I understand it, have not called for an armed struggle against the Sisi regime. But if they did, they would be in a far stronger position with far more popular support than the so-called rebels in Syria, who actually haven't got much support. When they took over Aleppo several years ago, they were interviewed by a Guardian journalist and said, we haven't got much support around here.
Do you think they might be supplied with
us.
Weapons through Benghazi?
In Syria?
No, the Muslim Brotherhood, if they decide to rise up.
The Muslim Brotherhood, to be fair, I think they've adopted, and they have over the years, adopted a fairly resolutely non-violent approach to what they do. So they've taken an awful lot of repression over the years, but they haven't responded violently.
It hasn't really done very, very well for them, though, that, has it?
No.
Because you've got a situation now where, during the Arab Spring and with the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood being elected, you've then got a whole sort of load of people who've been come forward as political activists. What's happened effectively is that whole sort of tranche of political activists has now been either executed or is in jail for life.
Yeah, and the government's also...
So it's a way of almost flushing
The government's also repressing non-Muslim Brotherhood activists as well.
It's pretty horrific what's going on in
Egypt. It is, but what I would suggest that you want to look for, both in Syria and in Egypt, is a negotiated solution where the various political forces are allowed to operate so that we can get a good idea of what people actually want. If we're going to go for this, we're going to have an armed struggle to overthrow everybody. Well, let's be logical about that. There's got to be an armed struggle to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia, and that means an armed struggle against NATO and the British. And patriots would have every right to kill and maim and murder if that's what we're going to do.
Okay, we've just been talking about Egypt and Syria. What do you see as the future for these countries?
Well, the creation of chaos in the Middle East is part of the US strategy and the Israeli strategy to prevent the Russians and the Chinese from developing the region but with their new Silk Road project that they're pushing. So the creation of chaos in the Middle East serves a purpose. It frustrates the positive economic development that the Russians and the Chinese would like to bring, and the Iranians would like to bring to the region. And so it's not just a question of controlling the oil, it's and the resources, it's preventing others from controlling.
So why is Syria in the Middle East, and particularly Syria, so important for the Russians?
Well, the key to all of this is Iran, because of its location. And what the Chinese and the Russians want to do is develop, well, the Chinese in particular, what they call the new One Belt, One Road project, where they're going to use state-of-the-art maglev railways to they're going to bring them in Africa, they're going to bring them in Central Asia, and they want a non-capitalistic development, if you like, non-Western controlled, and the West has got to prevent that if they're going to stay top dog. It's silly, really, because there's no reason why we couldn't all cooperate to do all of this, and everybody could be a winner.
Why is the US?
But the Western powers don't want to accept that. They've always been the top dogs for the last 200 years. They're not accepting.
So why
second fiddle
is Israel
role.
And the US so upset about this?
Well, Israel in particular have got their wild cards, because they just want chaos in the countries around them so that they will dominate the region. And the US policy...
But they could dominate it economically, surely?
Well, they're going to dominate it economically anyway, but they can do that through chaos rather than through cooperation. And in any case, they don't like strong states... with big populations who've got the, basically call them out on what they're doing.
They're not
the
actually threatening them, are they?
Well, they're not directly, but they perceive it. I mean, don't forget, this is a small state with a small population. They've got nuclear weapons and an aggressive attitude. So they've been quite keen to see Syria destabilised. And the Western powers have been trying to get rid of the Arab Baath socialist regime in Syria since it came to power in the 1940s. There's been several coup attempts, and this is the latest in their desire to steer them in a different direction.
Okay, so has China been sort of kicked back, a pushback, pushed out?
Well, China has never had traditionally a strong role in the region, but of course they want to develop one. But you can understand that the oligarchy in the United States and the fanatics in Israel are determined that that's not to happen.
They've called for East Jerusalem to be the capital of Palestine. So is that realistic? In China, the Chinese
that is the position that is a logical position. The UN in general calls for that, so the Chinese are just supporting the general position of the UN there. But of course, Trump is talking about moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which of course is not the UN's policy.
Well, as I said at the top of the hour, a carrier strike force has been sent by the US Navy to the Korean Peninsula, chugging on its way there right now. And this is because the intelligence is telling us, apparently, that Pyongyang plans to do another nuclear test. They've been testing out various ballistic missiles. They're doing this without absolutely totally outside the test ban treaty, aren't they, Martin?
They are, because they're not signatories to it. So they're not bound by it.
Like which other countries are not signatories to it?
Like the Israelis are not signatories to it. But I'll tell you who is a signatory to it: the Iranians.
But they're not. Testing nukes, are they? The Israelis.
They have. They have in the
not
past.
Not anymore.
Well, no, they haven't done. They tested one in the South Atlantic. In the 1990s or 1980s.
You've got some ideas of where some
I'm getting information
from.
That they may be actually buying the warheads on the black market from arms dealers like John Bradenkamp, who's based in Somerset, who used to be Rhodesian SAS, and Billy Reutenbach.
What, still?
Yeah. So it may be that... You see, there is a question about
where would he have got them from?
He got them from the South Africans, because the South Africans and Israelis developed them together.
That's decades ago.
Yes, but
the South Africans gave up their nukes.
Yeah, but the point is that some of them disappeared into the black market and have reappeared in North Korea. And also the other possibility is that they've got hold of nuclear plutonium warheads that the Americans lost in the first Gulf War. Well, that's what I'm being told. Well, I don't know whether it's
surely
true.
Surely somebody has to stop Pyongyang.
No. If once Pyongyang has got nuclear weapons, how can you stop them? What can you do? The Israelis have got nuclear weapons. Who can stop them? Who can take them off them? You could have economic sanctions on them and say, unless you give up your nuclear weapons, Israel, we are not going to aid or trade, you won't be able to travel, etc., etc. But there's no danger of that at the minute because they've got the West in their pockets. The Pyongyang, from Pyongyang's point of view, this is absolutely quite logical. Countries that haven't got nuclear weapons, like Libya, like Iraq, like Syria, they get invaded. We've got nuclear weapons, don't mess with us. And don't forget, nearly a quarter of the population of North Korea was killed by Allied bombing during the Korean War. They're not just the bad guys. We've done some pretty nasty things to the Koreans. Korea as a whole used to be a Japanese colony, and they were pretty brutal. And they were pretty brutal from 1905 onwards. So the Communist Party in North Korea has actually got some political support. And the South Koreans aren't very keen on the Americans turning up with their battle fleet. They are saying, why don't we negotiate with the North Koreans? And there's about to be a presidential election in South Korea. And the more liberal, radical candidates may win. And they are saying, we don't want a confrontation with North Korea. Who does want a confrontation with North Korea? The Americans and Trump want a confrontation with North Korea.
We've got a bit
the
of
South
a,
Koreans a, don't. They're not bit, interested in it.
A bit of a Brazil-type situation has been going on last month in South Korea with the ousting judicial coup, I would call it, of Park Geun-hye, who's the South Korean president. Now the country's just being run by its prime minister. It has no president in South Korea, and one does wonder whether this is in preparation for something.
No, well, there's a bit of a difference. The coup in Brazil was carried out by pro-Western...
A judicial coup
was carried out by pro-Western forces who wanted to get rid of Dilma Rousseff, who was tortured by the military regime in the 1960s, and is a member of the Workers' Party. The coup in South Korea, or the political change in South Korea, is because you've got a pro-American right-winger who's been forced out for corruption, and they are... Dilma Rousseff isn't corrupt, but she's been forced out by corrupt people. The South Korean president was corrupt and has been forced out by popular pressure. And they do not want to deploy the candidates in the upcoming presidential election in South Korea do not want anti-missile systems deployed in South Korea because they think it's provocative. And what they want to do is go back to what they call the Sunshine Policy, where we talk to the North Koreans, we do joint ventures with them, and we try and, you know, basically get along with them. And of course, that is actually the purpose of all of this, as we're going to come to in a minute, is about the containment of China. That's what this is really about. Okay, North Korea are just pawns in that game.
She's actually under arrest, the elected president now in South Korea. In fact, in solitary confinement.
Yeah, but she's been forced out by popular pressure. And she's actually a warmongering hardliner, so that's not such a bad thing. But of course, what the Americans are now trying to put in this anti-missile system into South Korea before the new president can come into power, because the new president is likely to say, we don't want it. And in any case, if the North Koreans have another nuclear test, they've had several, what difference does it make? I mean, they've got nuclear weapons. And saying that we are going to attack them just means that they might use them. You can't attack countries that have got nuclear weapons. That's why they've got them. Because countries that don't have nuclear weapons just get attacked. And the North Koreans quite logically have drawn the conclusion, we've got to have nuclear weapons. That's why Britain's got nuclear weapons, so that nobody dares to attack us. That's the theory.
We also hear this week that China has deployed 150,000 troops, well, we haven't heard that much on our mainstream media, to the North Korean border.
They have.
Hearing on the news tonight as well that flights between Beijing and Pyongyang have been stopped.
Well, the Chinese have got a very tricky situation here because the Americans are using the North Koreans as an excuse to bring military forces to bear which could be used against China. And the Chinese and North Koreans are still allies, kind of, although the Chinese are finding them a very, you know, very awkward to deal with. But the North Koreans have got their own interests. They feel that they have to have nuclear weapons because they're not under the Chinese nuclear umbrella. If they were attacked by the Americans, the Chinese aren't going to go to nuclear war for the North Koreans. So the North Koreans logically feel that they have to have nuclear weapons to prevent themselves being attacked. And you might say, well, the West would never attack North Korea. They're paranoid. But that's not the way they perceive it. Don't forget, we've been charging around the planet, attacking all sorts of different countries. The attack on Syria has made it absolutely clear that the Americans are quite capable of doing stupid
NATO
stuff.
NATO seems to have been attacking quite a lot of countries, yes, which are very far away from their core countries.
That's right. So if you were a little North Korea and you knew that you were on the part of the axis of evil and all the rest of it, it would be perfectly logical for you to have nuclear weapons so you don't mess with us because we will retaliate. And there's nothing you can do about that.
But North Korean nuclear weapons, it doesn't look like they can just about reach Australia, but they couldn't reach the US, surely?
No, but they could possibly reach Japan, which is their traditional enemy. And they could also just dump it on top of this task force, for example, that's coming in there. And so, you wouldn't kill loads of civilians, you just kill loads of US military personnel. And of course, any use of nuclear weapons by anybody is likely to make large chunks of the planet uninhabitable.
Well, we did hear.
But what can you do?
Election campaign that Donald Trump was going to be reasonably friendly with the Chinese.
He was being quite hostile to the Chinese.
But anyway, North
but
Korea.
He's now backed off on it.
Well, he was also talking about no new wars, wasn't he? And now he's saying the US will act alone. Whatever that means, act alone on North Korea if China fails to help.
Yeah, well, they're not even going to ask the South Koreans.
That is really.
You'd have thought the South Koreans might want to have something to say in this, but they're going to be told what to do by their American masters.
Not only a direct threat to attack North Korea, but also a threat to China.
Yep, and the problem with Trump tweeting at 3 a.m, as he does, is that once you've said stuff, you can't back down. So he's now locked himself into conflict on several fronts. And the Russians and the Chinese may well be coming to the conclusion that there is a plot to attack them and to undermine their economies and societies. And at that point, the Chinese generally have steered clear of getting involved in foreign entanglements of any kind, apart from economic deals. But I mean, I think if they feel that the Americans are going to, for example, try to control the South China Sea, don't forget that the Chinese depend an awful lot on import of raw materials through the South China Sea. They can't. I mean, it would be like Britain. If the Chinese Navy turned up and said we are going to control the North Sea, we wouldn't like it, would we? We'd get upset. And the Chinese are getting upset about us. And can I just mention in this context the blockade on Yemen, which is being carried out by the Saudis and the British and the Americans helping them, which is leading to starvation in Yemen. So we've got the Disasters Emergency Committee in Britain saying people in Yemen and East Africa are all starving. They're starving because we're blockading the ports and preventing food from coming in. That's what we are doing as we speak. And we're also dropping all sorts of munitions all over these people.
Well,
at a certain point, there's a red line drawn, and something's got to be done, and war's got to be fought. I'm not a pacifist. Nobody's a pacifist. It's about time the Americans and the British were given a bloody nose and lost a few teeth, isn't it?
What about this one thing I was saying about moral and economic bankruptcy? Do you think that's kind of behind this? Because I'm looking at the amount of money the United States is spending on defence these days. So they call it defence, but they seem to be just attacking. I mean, it just seemed very Orwellian.
It's Orwellian.
Is the headline in Quartz magazine last month was Trump's proposed increase in US military spending is almost as big as Russia's entire defence budget. This is written by Max de Holvenang. It's as US President Donald Trump was proposing a $54 billion defence spending hike last month, something rather different was happening in Russia. With its economy spluttering, there are reports it will slash its military budget by 25%. The actual figure is actually more likely to be around 5%, says Mark Galotti, a Russian security expert at the Institute for International Relations in Prague. And it comes after several years of rapid growth in Russia's defence spending. That still reveals a stark discrepancy. Trump wants to bolster America's military spending with an amount not far short of Russia's entire 2016 defence budget of $65.8 billion. That's 3.8 trillion rubles. So just looking at it, it's easy to work this out. Even I can figure this one. The Russians spend about a tenth that the Americans do on defence.
Yes, and they're actually cutting back on it because they've actually got an adequate supply of equipment to do the jobs that they want to do, which is basically defending themselves and their allies. The Americans like spending money on military stuff because that's where the politicians make their private profits. They're all a part of the Carlyle Group and all the rest of it, and they get seamlessly moved from being senators or whatever to being on the boards of the companies like Raytheon and so on. So Raytheon's shares went up after the attack on Syria because they're obviously going to be supplying more cruise missiles, although I think that the Russians are able to spend less because their kit produced by the public sector is actually superior and their strategic doctrines are superior. And I think if it comes to a war, NATO will lose even though they've outspent everybody because they waste so much money on useless stuff because it costs. They like spending money on it, very expensive stuff, because that's the way of fleecing their own taxpayers. But from a military point of view, it's rubbish. And of course, they're actually exhausted.
It depends what your military objectives are, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, actually, the military objectives are, if they are to balkanise the Middle East, well, tick, well done.
No, I think I think the Russians have got the measure of them. The Chinese have got the measure of them as well. If it comes to a fight in the South China Sea, the US Navy will be defeated. If there is an air attack on Syria carried out by NATO, there will be massive NATO casualties. Both the Mediterranean and the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, are in fact death traps. And the navies are obsolete. That's what's going to happen. They've got loads of aircraft carriers. They're fighting World War II. The Russians and the Chinese are fighting World War III, and that's why they're going to win and the West's going to lose.
The Defence Department in the US bases its annual spending proposals. That's this massive increase in US defence spending, $54 billion. On being able to conduct wars in two regions at the same time. Okay, the Defence Department conducting wars in two regions at the same time. That doesn't sound quite like defence to me. While also having a deterrent presence and counter-terrorism operations in several others. But Galotti says arguments that more spending is directly needed are tremendously overblown when potential foes like Russia are so behind. It's very hard to sustain any kind of notion, he says, that Russia actually plans any kind of direct military challenge to the West.
Unless they're attacked. And that means in Syria as elsewhere. But of course, the defence in warfare has an advantage. Of course, the attackers have an advantage if they attack by surprise, but once you've taken that away, defenders are in fact in a stronger position than attackers.
Well, so let's have a listen now to a clip from John Pilger's film from November 2016. It's called The Coming War on China, and in it he talks to several senior people in the US defence system, as well as clips from the US officers, military officers, really talking about their real plans for China. The sort of stuff that we don't hear very much on the mainstream news. We'll put a link up to this YouTube film on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's hear the beginning of that film, The Coming War on China, by the British and I would say he's actually Australian journalist. He's been doing stuff, actually, Martins, isn't he, since the Vietnam War, John Pilger?
Yes.
He comes out with a film about every 2 years.
He's a great voice of truth and reason in the world, crazy world we live in.
We continue our look this morning at what China does not want you to see. The United States says the superpower is reclaiming land in the South China Sea.
The fact that we're dealing with a situation right now where we, the U.S., has to be much more aggressive in dealing with the Chinese government.
CNN has learned that the U.S. Navy is about to send a destroyer there. Let's go to our CNN chief.
CNN got exclusive access to classified U.S. surveillance flights over the islands.
The threat of China is becoming big news. The media is beating the drums of war as the world is being primed to regard China as a new enemy.
China's alarming creation of entirely new territory in the South China Sea is one part of a broader military push that some fear is to challenge U.S. dominance in the region.
China is building airstrips in the South China Sea on disputed islands condemned by an international tribunal. This is now a flashpoint for war between China and America. What is not news is that China itself is under threat. These American bases form a giant noose encircling China with missiles, bombers, warships, all the way from Australia through the Pacific to Asia and beyond.
I mean, if you were in Beijing looking out, you stood on the tallest building in Beijing and looked out at the Pacific Ocean, you'd see American warships. You'd see Guam is about to sink because there's so many missiles pointed at China. You'd look up at Korea and see American armaments pointing at China. You'd see Japan, which is basically the glove over the American fist. I think if I was Chinese, I'd have a little to worry about American aggressiveness.
And we have China surrounded, and we're doing more all the time to try and keep it surrounded and deepen that containment of China. But China presents a fascinating case of a country that is independent, doesn't have foreign bases on its territory, growing very rapidly, not as rapidly now as it did for 30 years, but still the second-ranking economy in the world.
We have an adversary, and that adversary is China. And that adversary, unless there is dramatic reform inside China, will be our enemy someday.
One myth, I think really that needs to be dispelled, was that somehow China's aiming to replace America and going to run the world. Mm. It's not. Well, first of all, the Chinese are not that stupid. The West, with its Christian roots, are about converting other people into their beliefs. The Chinese are not about that. It's just the I'm not degrading the Western culture. I'm just pointing out the inherent nature, the DNA is of two different cultures. The Chinese, 2,000 years ago, built the Great Wall to keep the barbarians out, not to invade them.
As the world's economic power moves rapidly to Asia, the response of the United States is to deploy the majority of its naval forces to Asia and the Pacific. This massive military buildup is known in Washington as the pivot to Asia. The target is China. The great power game in the 21st century is called perpetual war. For America's unchallenged arms industry, the annual prize is huge profits from almost $600 billion of military spending.
Once an imaginary weapon on Star Wars, the electromagnetic gun is now reality.
You're sitting there thinking about these next generation and futuristic ideas, and we've got scientists who have designed these, and it's coming to life.
And the smartest weapons need enemies. The aim of this film is to break a silence. The United States and China may well be on a path to war, and nuclear war is no longer unthinkable. In a few years, China has become the world's second biggest economic power. The United States is the world's biggest military power, with bases and missiles and ships covering every continent, every ocean. China is a threat to this dominance, says Washington. But who is the threat? This film is about shifting power and great danger. It's also a film about the human spirit and the rise of an extraordinary resistance among people on the front line of a coming war, where the words never again have an urgent meaning for all of us.
Well, Martin, that's just the beginning of that nearly 2 hours, an hour and three-quarter film by John Pilger. Quite an important bit of work, and nobody else really around the world seems to be putting this on our television screens. ITV screened it in November quite late at night, and not a whisper afterwards.
Yeah, well, Pilger's managed to carve out a niche for himself, partly in the mainstream, partly outside it. And I think, you know, the dogs in the street know that there's a potential for a world war here. And it's, that's the general staff in China, the general staff in Russia, the general staff in Iran. They are preparing for war. They'd be completely irresponsible if they didn't in the circumstances.
Are we looking at a sort of global conflict potentially with China on one side, United States on the other? This sounds a little bit like
1984. No, it's going to be the Shanghai Cooperation Organization versus NATO. That's what it's going to be.
Is Russia in the Shanghai Cooperation?
Yeah. The SCO is the Chinese.
So Russia have definitely thrown their cards in with the Chinese?
Yep. Because they wanted to do a deal with the West Europeans.
Actually, they were in the G7.
But the West Europeans just do what the Americans say, so that's the end of that.
When it was the G8, the Russians were in the G7, weren't they?
They were in the G8, because it's now reverted to the G7. So what the West wants is pro-Western regimes in both Moscow and Beijing. That's what they want. And there are some political forces in both societies which are oriented in that direction. But I think the belligerent attitude in the West has actually marginalised those forces. Medvedev in Russia, who is the prime minister, was regarded at one stage as a potential, you know, Trojan horse person. But he is now lined up firmly with Putin. And I think that the more pro-Western wing of the Chinese Communist Party have been marginalised, because there's no deal to be done with the West. The West is a bully. The West is only interested, and the Americans in particular, only interested in being top dog. They don't want to share power. They don't want to. They don't want to discuss anything really. And at that point, there's nothing much to discuss. We're just preparing to fight.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM.
Sorry about that. 93.2, I think it is, that we're on. Also, Martin, this week we've heard about this school siege at Beslan. The European Court has condemned Russia for its role in that 2004 massacre when so many people were killed. I suppose the first question, actually, is why is the European Court getting involved in a case like this when it happened rather a long way away from Europe, over in South Ossetia?
Well, I'm not quite sure about this, but I believe that the European Court has, you know, the Russians are part of it, and therefore that, you know, there's a legitimate reason for them to stick there to say something. Although I think the timing is extremely suspicious that they've dragged this incident back up.
1,100 hostages were taken back in 2004. Mm. After 52 hours, the Russians sent in the special forces. 334 people were killed, including nearly 200 children. I mean, it's horrendous.
Yes, it was. And of course, the hostage takers were Chechen extremists who had been armed and trained by the Saudis, the British and the Americans.
How do you know that?
Listen, the evidence is overwhelming that the Chechen rebels were getting support, certainly from the Saudis and also from Western intelligence services, because they wanted to destabilise Russia. So this whole thing, Kadyrov, who's now in charge in Chechnya, was originally a rebel against Russian rule. He's now become aligned with Putin. The Guardian's front page today has got a whole thing about how the Chechen government has been very repressive to homosexuals. I'm sure that's true. But if the rebels had won the Chechen war, the people that took the Beslan school, then the problem for homosexuals in Chechnya would be far worse. There's an awful lot of bad blood and simply manipulation going on here.
The case was brought by 409 people, including those injured and taken as hostage in the attack itself, as well as family members of those killed. The Kremlin described the court's conclusion as unacceptable, and spokesman said Russia could not agree with its ruling. Well, the other thing is, what is the point of holding a court case in a court which has no jurisdiction in Russia?
Well, I mean, as you say, people involved have taken it to the European Court because Russia has some dealings with it.
So it's gone out in the press, but there's actually no consequences of this. Even though this is a European Court, it has absolutely no consequences other than lines in the news.
Well, it's a political manoeuvre, isn't it? You can understand the Russians didn't carry out exactly a surgical operation there. But what do you do? What would you do if Al-Qaeda terrorists seized the city academy that we're sitting in here and took all of the children prisoner? What would the SAS do?
I think they're
how would you deal with
effectively
it?
That the Russians just didn't have the capability to deal with that situation. Also, another story this week.
Do?
Another good documentary on the BBC. Not often we have. It must be Holy Week, mustn't it? Mm. Two good documentaries on the BBC. Another one was investigation by John Ware, veteran, brilliant investigative journalist. He worked on, I think it was even World in Action years ago, and then became head of Panorama. Murders linked to the IRA spy Steak Knife were not properly investigated, with the director of public prosecutions over in Ireland having a very good look at the Force Research Unit now. A proper investigation.
Yeah, well, John Ware also did Panorama programmes in the past about the Force Research Unit and their close links to the Loyalist paramilitary campaign.
This is all about Freddie Scappaticci.
Yeah. Well,
he's linked, let's just spell it out, he's linked to at least 18 murders, including, it may be best not to say names, but anyway, this is an ongoing investigation. But this is a proper investigation going on in Northern Ireland. One of the things that shocked me about the documentary is when Sir John Stevens went over to do his investigation, he was speaking to the army and they assured him that they had no agents whatever within the Republican movement.
Yeah, well, don't forget that Scappaticci was head of the Nutting Squad, so-called, which was internal counterintelligence. So what he was doing on behalf of the Force Research Unit is he was accusing loyal IRA members of being traitors and having them, interrogated and executed. Meanwhile, the real moles inside the IRA were being protected by Scappaticci, who was also being protected from investigations by the police to make sure that his role continued. And I think that it's very murky waters, isn't it? The Force Research Unit, there's a Panorama programme by Donal McIntyre over a year ago now, perhaps a bit more, where he was pointing out that the Force Research Unit, the head of the Nuala O'Loan, the head of the police ombudswoman for Northern Ireland, said, well, the Force Research Unit, we've got evidence that they were involved in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. Hundreds. So when people talk about the ceasefire and the IRA finally giving up the armed struggle, they've got to remember that the British Army itself was involved in hundreds of murders.
If you want to have a look at this, check out Operation Kenova, K-E-N-O-V-A, that is. Right, well, that's time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, as Lib Dem Group leader, councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins, also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You just heard there, our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This short show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car, iPlayer or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and long, enjoyable BCFM Easter weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1992. It's Lisa Taylor. So do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Spoken, you know.
and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.